Lecture 21, Legendary Dynasties of China.
When we think the discovery of civilization, we have a tendency to think of Mediterranean lands, of Egypt and Mesopotamia, of Rome and Greece, the familiar, well-trodden territory of archaeologist and historian alike. But in this lecture, we're going to show you that there was a great deal more to the discovery of the civilizations than the Maya, the Egyptians, and the Sumerians. We're going to travel to the other side of the world and look at the discovery of early civilization in China. Chinese legend is rich in stories of the first royal dynasties of northern China, Xia, Shang, and Chu. But the question of questions is whether these legends hold any historical truth. This lecture describes how archaeologists have puzzled over Shang civilization and its predecessors and successors as a result of discoveries of hundreds of oracle bones made from the shoulder blades of cattle, which archaeologists found in northern Chinese drugstores in the 1920s. Their purchases led them to the ancient Shang royal capital at Anyang on the Huanghe River, or the Yellow River, where they excavated the precincts of Shang rulers and replaced legend with historical fact which we describe in the second part of this lecture. They also described spectacular royal burials, which they excavated as a result of accidental discoveries. And then we end the lecture with a much more recent dramatic discovery, that of the finds at the tomb of China's first emperor, Shi Huangdi. Chinese legends tell us that he was the first emperor of a unified China. And in fact, this has been proven historical fact. As I just said, Chinese legend said that there were three great royal dynasties at the dawn of civilization in China: Xia, Shang, and Shu. The Chinese themselves have a long tradition of antiquarianism, which dates back to a revival of interest in ancient court culture, which occurred during the Song Dynasty of the 10th to 13th centuries AD. This, in turn, was prompted by a surge in Neo-Confucianism, which embraced ancient rituals using many artifacts from much earlier dynasties. According to 18th century Neo-Confucianism, the essence of things could best be grasped through wide learning, careful investigation, exact thinking, and clear reasoning, to say nothing of sincere conduct. This included the scientific study of the past. There was a long tradition in China to the effect that the past offers precedent for the present and future. And most archaeology in China, even today, is based on this notion that there are lessons that can be learnt from the study of the past. The earliest of these legendary civilizations is that of the Xia. As far as we can tell from legend, we still know very little about Xia. It began as a loose federation of small kingdoms in modern-day southern Shaanxi and in western Henan provinces of the north. As far as we can tell, the heyday of the Xia may have been towards the end of the third millennium to the middle of the second millennium BC. That is to say, the same time as Egypt's middle kingdom. Not the kingdom of Tutankhamun, but the one before. So far, we don't know the names of any Shia rulers, nor have we any idea of the size of their domains. The Shia are still in the world of legend, although future archaeological excavations may well place them firmly on the recorded stage of history. With the Shang, we get onto firmer historical ground. They replaced the Shia rulers, a new dynasty of rulers, around 1600 BC. Unlike Shia, the existence of Shang civilization is well attested from archaeological discoveries of all kinds. And this really is the crux of the story of the discovery of civilization in China. As long ago as 1899, some strange artifacts began turning up in medicinal stores in northern China. The shoulder blades of oxen. These were ground up and turned into drugs. Now, many of these were inscribed with a simple form of script scratched into the bone. The scholars who examined these realized at once that they were oracle bones. In other words, they had been used in rituals of divination. The bones had been scraped down the back side, cavities hollowed out of them, and then a metal rod inserted into the cavity. This hot metal rod, which had been heated carefully, produced cracks on the front surface. These cracks were the message. They were read by a diviner who was answering questions posed to him by the ruler or lord. Was it, for example, auspicious to go hunting? Would the harvest be good? Was this a good time to raid one's neighbors? The diviner would examine the cracks and provide an answer. The bones were inscribed with the questions, then stored in the archives. The diviner was consulting the ancestors. But clearly, it was prudent for the diviner to produce a politically acceptable answer, because the penalty otherwise might have been very severe. So the diviners probably, like all spirit minions and shamans, kept a careful ear on the wisps of public opinion in formulating their answers. But these oracle bones were one thing. But where did they come from was another. By questioning dozens of storekeepers, archaeologists from the National Academies Institute of History and Philology followed a track of these bones back in a classic archaeological detective story to Anyang, a place called Anyang in the Huangho River Valley. In 1928, the archaeologists, under the leadership of a Harvard University-trained archaeologist named Li Chai, dug into Anyang and discovered an ancient capital of the Shang rulers. They found evidence of a 3,200-year-old civilization of farmers and expert bronze workers. Now, Anyang was not a tightly packed city like the cities of Mesopotamia. It was instead a vast network, and I mean vast, of royal compounds, palaces, temples, villages, and workshops covering no less than 120 square miles on the north bank of the Huangho River. This civilization one can think of really in a way as a form of circles. At the center of it was the ruler and the court. The ruler, his family, the big neighbor, nobles. Around it were circles of artisans, soldiers, priests, and then outside, in a huge green circle, as it were, of farms and fields, were the mass of the commoners, the farmers, the green circle. The relationship between the ruler and the ruled was based very firmly on ancestral ties and other such social contracts. But the Shang civilization still remained a rather shadowy entity. It was really defined by compounds, oracle bones, magnificent bronze objects made with molds, where wax was replaced by metal, and not much else. We knew little about the royal personages or the structure of society. But fortunately for science, in the 1920s and 1930s, and again in the 1960s, Chinese researchers unearthed Shang royal tombs northeast of Anyang. Like at Ur, the royal dead lay in deep burial pits, buried this time in wooden burial chambers, surrounded by lavish offerings of gold and jade and dozens of sacrificial victims, many of them decapitated. They were buried with magnificent bronze food and drinking vessels made, as I said, using elaborate clay molds. This was a society where everything flowed to the center, where wealth and religious power were very carefully maintained as a royal prerogative. Shang rulers, like other early civilizations, stayed in power in considerable part not because of their spiritual authority, but because of their standing armies, their soldiers, the constant threat that if an outlying community gave trouble, an army would be there raping and pillaging and inflicting punishment within a short time. And we know this because some of the burials in Shang cemeteries include chariot units. One such wooden chariot, drawn by two horses, came from a royal grave in 1973. The wooden structure of the chariot itself had gone, but by meticulous excavation of the darkened outline, the Chinese were able to reconstruct the outline of the chariot and show that this, in fact, was a weapon of war. So Shang civilization, as we know it again, like Hia, was a patchwork of competing rulers, of capitals that moved constantly, that were very dispersed, because it was only later in Chinese history that cities became compact and densely populated. It was a spread-out civilization, and not the only state to be formed in China at the time. There is clear reason to believe that similar states were forming in other parts of the country, especially in the south, but still very little is known. Where we do know a great deal, however, is from the archaeology of later times. Following the Shang and the Shao dynasties, and a period of warring states in China, China was unified into a single kingdom by the Emperor Shi Huangdi in 221 BC. Shi Huangdi, by all accounts, was a ruthless conqueror and an extremely efficient administrator. He was a despot. He was paranoid to the point that when he died, his death was hidden for fear his kingdom would come apart. He commissioned his sepulchre long before he died. It lies near the modern city of Xianyang, on the banks of the Wei River. It is, quite simply, enormous. By all accounts, Shi Huangdi was a megalomaniac. He certainly was buried on a magnificent scale. During the 1970s, farmers ploughing near the Royal Burial Mound, whose location has always been known, came across some life-size terracotta figures, figures of soldiers. Local archaeologists investigated, and they found that these figures were part of a regiment of terracotta soldiers buried in ranks in huge pits located to the sides of Shi Huangdi's sepulchre. The armies, they were not much less, the regiments, were in their order of deployment. Armed cavalrymen, kneeling archers, infantrymen and officers, perhaps a ceremonial guard for the dead emperor. These are standardized figures with individualized expressions. Once brightly painted, today you can only see fragments of the bright colors which delineated one rank from another, one role from another. And if ever you are near an exhibition where one of the figures or more are shown, I strongly recommend you go and see them. They really are not only startlingly realistic, but created with an assurance of style which really beggars the imagination. So does the Royal Burial Mound. It measures more than 1,100 feet on each side and rises 140 feet above the surrounding countryside. Legends as to its contents abound. They say that the constellations of the heavens appear on the ceiling of the burial chamber, that a map of the emperor's domains, complete with rivers flowing in mercury on the floor, lays out the scope of his kingdom. There are said to be scale models of palaces and pavilions, which contain the royal possessions, accompanied by models of his courtiers and numerous sacrificial victims. If ever there was a royal burial site which would redefine our knowledge of Chinese civilization and would really make the Tutankhamun's tomb or the royal lords of Sipan in Peru, which we'll talk about in the last lecture, look like village monarchs, it would be the tomb of Shi Huangdi. But fortunately, and this is a fascinating reflection on archaeology, the Chinese authorities have wisely delayed any excavation of the Royal Burial Mound until they have the resources and expertise to do it properly. You see, what we're looking at here is an era where archaeology hasn't just become a frantic scramble for spectacular antiquities. It has become a systematic, disciplined search for civilization, for minute detail of the past. As I said, in the case of the Ur-Royal Burials, and in the case of Tutankhamun, these excavations were done with, by today's standards, extraordinarily primitive technology. They were done without lasers, without AMS, radiocarbon dating, without carbon isotope analysis, pollen analysis, all the minute high-tech approaches which archaeologists can now bring to bear on spectacular discoveries like Shui Huangdi. As was said of Otzi the Iceman, the famous Bronze Age Iceman from the Alps, 3100 BC, the oldest human in Europe, of whom whose countenance we can gaze upon, we know more about his medical history and death than he ever knew in life, thanks to modern technology. And the Chinese have a patience about the investigation of the past, which we impatient Westerners would be wise to learn. And that is that the discovery of civilization is not a matter of finding it now. It's a matter today of very carefully measuring the benefits of science against the benefits of spectacular discovery. And in the Chinese mind, and correctly, I'm one to admire them for this, the science comes first. Because, as we've said again and again in this course, the records of the past are finite, and this record is infinitely precious and can never be replaced. I, for one, hope that I will have long been pushing up daisies when they come round to excavate the royal tomb of Shui Duangdi. Simply, not because I regret missing this, but simply because by doing it in a measured way, when they are ready, they are really expressing the essence of what is responsible archaeology, deliberate investigation of a find with all the apparatus that we can bring to bear upon it. Not two Europeans and hundreds of laborers, but a multidisciplinary team of scholars investigating detail down in these tombs to the content of the vessels which were placed with the dead emperor. This is where the realm of archaeological discovery in the future lies, in looking at the trivial and the minute as much as at the spectacular. And I wager with you that many of these minute finds will in their way be just as interesting and spectacular as the gold from Tutankhamun's tomb or the royal burials at Ur. And that is one of the reasons why Shui Huangdi's tomb is such an important discovery and why it's so important to wait to investigate it. We will learn a great deal more by waiting. In the meantime, other discoveries have come to light around the mound. These include two half-scale bronze chariot models, complete with horses. These are replicas of royal transportation of Shui Huangdi's day. They have found underground stables, some of them with underground mangers, where horses have been buried alive. So the discoveries just around the tomb have barely begun. Because there's another important point to make about archaeology here, archaeology on a large scale. Shui Huangdi was a man of grandiose vision. He was a megalomaniac. He conceived of his burial not just as a mound, but an entire mortuary precinct. It took a lifetime to build. Well, it should also take a lifetime to excavate. And the essence of much archaeology today is not the sort of quick tunneling that Austin Henry Layard did into Nineveh. Not the 8 years that Howard Carter took to clear Tutankhamun's tomb. Or the 10 years or more that Ur took to excavate. But lifetime excavations which slowly pieced together the pictures of civilizations from teeny clues over generations. Because in the final analysis, if we don't do it right, we lose it. Chinese archaeologists have made spectacular discoveries from later periods as well. Among them, the undisturbed burials of Han Dynasty nobles of about 2,000 years ago. For example, there were several burials known where both nobles and noble women have been buried in suits made of jade plaques. These hundreds of plaques joined with golden thread form a bodysuit, as it were, within which the body of the deceased was fitted. The idea being that this jade would assure the body immortality. When they were discovered, these were nothing more than a collapsed pile of plaques and golden wire. The immortality had failed. Fabrics, magnificent jars, all the panoply of wealth were with these tombs. But all of this burial, which was a burial done with tremendous assurance, was an assurance among the people who were buried that their traditions of civilization were absolutely correct, and that the way they treated the commoner, which was harshly, with lives of unremitting toil, was entirely correct. Because you cannot entirely blame them, because the roots of Han civilization and of other later Chinese dynasties go back deep into the past, to the legendary dynasties of 4,000 years ago or more. The tradition of civilization in China is at least 1,000 years younger than that in Egypt and Mesopotamia. It is less well understood, especially in its earlier connotations, but its achievement was just as magnificent. And the discoveries of the Shang oracle bones, the discoveries at Anyang, the discoveries of Shi Huangdi's tomb, all show that the basic essence of a pre-industrial civilization, whether it be in Egypt, whether it be in Mesopotamia, whether it be in Mycenae or anywhere else, was based on a very simple fact. A teeny minority of society succeeded in dominating and controlling the labor of thousands of commoners for the benefit of a few. In the case of Chinese civilization, it was done with a harsh form of authoritarian rule, which is reflected in the dozens of sacrificial victims buried with the royal dead, with the segregation of royal precincts from those of other members of society, and the notion that the roots of civilization were very deep and that the precedents of the past guided the present and future. This was, like pharaonic civilization, one that twisted and turned, but the continuity of civilization in China from Xia, Shang, and Shu is remarkable. Chinese writing, for example, goes back centuries before Shang and can be seen in a rudimentary form on the oracle bones. What were the ultimate roots of early Chinese civilization? We don't entirely know. Xia probably is one of the many dynasties of rulers who were beginning to forge their own states back in those early days. But at the moment, the archaeological record is still incomplete. This is because the pace of archaeological research lags way behind that in the West, and in another century, we're likely to have a much more complex picture to deal with. The picture I've given you here is a picture of northern China, of the Shang, of the Huanghe River. But in the south is the Yangtze, a great fertile river, where rice cultivation began at least as early as 6,000 BC, and where very complex farming societies were flourishing by 4,000 BC. Almost certainly, civilizations to rival those of Shang and Xia were developing in the Yangtze at much the same time, perhaps even earlier, based on the rich and fertile soils of the river valley there. These civilizations, when discovered and defined, may completely change the picture of Chinese civilization we have at the moment, which is derived very largely from excavations conducted before World War II and in the last 20 years. It is a rapidly changing situation. But this, of course, is the fascination of the discovery of the early civilizations. We have hardly begun, and in areas like China, we are still in scientific infancy.